I don't either.
Every day.
And Ty's good.
And they got a little thing.
Okay,
like,
ready,
we'll
guys?
Check.
We're good.
The government deer system and see if you get.
Hello, everyone. I'm opening. Today is April 8th, 2015. I'm opening the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3364. Representative Whitsitt, you can come up while Robin reads the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3364 adds mental illness, disease, and other medical condition to definition of intellectual disability related to support services provided by the Department of Human Services.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, committee members. I'm Representative Gail Whitsitt. I represent the southern half of Klamath and Lake Counties, House District 56, and a former member of this great committee. I'm here today to speak on House Bill 3364. I brought this bill on behalf of one of my constituents, Dr. Ralph Eccles of Klamath Falls. Dr. Eccles' special interests include type 1 and type 2 diabetes, complications of pregnancy, especially diabetes, endocrinology, emphasis on reproductive problems, osteoporosis, and medical ethics. He works for Cascade East Family Practice Center, which is an OHSU practice that is based in Klamath Falls. Dr. Eccles has a strong concern about his patients that fall within the 70 to 80 IQ range. These are the patients that are falling through the cracks when it comes to receiving the care that they need. I received the following letter from Dr. Eccles, and I'm just going to read because he's the expert on this, and Dr. Steiner Hayward is on the bill, but she has a Senate committee right now, and she said that she would be happy to answer any questions from the committee. We just need to ask her afterwards. She can't be here. So Dr. Eccles' testimony reads, currently the state designates those citizens with intelligence at or below the third percentile as developmentally disabled and eligible for special services. The courts can also exercise a supervisory and protective role for these individuals. There is no question that these individuals need special protection and are very vulnerable. These are individuals with an IQ below 70. Those individuals at or below the 10th percentile present a special challenging situation, especially if they have serious chronic medical conditions. These are individuals with an IQ below 80. Individuals with an IQ in this gap from 70 to 80 are especially vulnerable. Persons with an IQ below 70 are either gravely disabled or have been protected and recognize the need for continued support as they are impaired enough that the impairment is obvious, often even to themselves. Persons with an IQ from 80 to 90 recognize that they often will need assistance and will have difficulty with challenging activities and will seek assistance. Individuals in this range where the IQ is from 70 to 80 are not able to recognize their own deficiencies and do not seek assistance. These individuals are easily victimized and have very poor judgment. When such an individual has a complex medical condition, such as type 1 diabetes or other condition that requires frequent monitoring and adjustment in medication, successful self-management is not possible. As a result, these individuals have multiple complications from the comorbidities of their diseases and frequently end up in the hospital or emergency department. All of this is a serious financial burden on the taxpayer. I have a patient with an IQ of 65 who is able to live in a special apartment, have visits from social services twice weekly, and attends a sheltered workshop. He enjoys being productive to society and having the social life of special sports teams. His diabetes is fairly well controlled in this supervised environment, and he has only mild complications and never has needed to visit the emergency room or be admitted to the hospital because of his diabetes. The same is true of another patient with Down syndrome and type 1 diabetes. I have four patients with type 1 diabetes and IQs from 70 to 80. These patients are not doing well. Frequently, they are in the hospital. A fifth patient died 2 years ago. Both of the female patients have been victimized on multiple occasions, and another patient was convinced by a drug dealer that methamphetamine would cure his diabetes. I am most familiar with diabetes, which is very difficult to manage, even for individuals of normal intelligence. But there are other diseases, such as congenital heart disease and some kinds of epilepsy and asthma, where complex medical regimes are indicated. However, diabetes is very common and growing, as well as type 1 juvenile diabetes is growing too. Complex of diseases that require support for all patients, but especially those of subnormal intelligence below 80. Sincerely, Dr. Ralph Eccles. As demonstrated by Dr. Eccles' letter, there is a definite need for patients with IQs in the 70 to 80 range to receive assistance. When my office discussed this legislation with Dr. Eccles, they conversed about the special waivers that people within the 70 to 80 IQ range can apply for in order to receive developmental disability services. During that conversation, Dr. Eccles discussed his experience with the waivers. Dr. Eccles stated that his patients within the IQ range are not cognitively able to recognize that they need help. If he's able to get the patient to understand that they need help, they don't have the cognitive ability to fill out the necessary paperwork to apply for the waivers. I recognize that there are certain groups who have concerns with this bill. Unfortunately, they did not come to my office in a timely manner with their concerns, and therefore I was unable to discuss at length the concerns before the hearing and actually investigate. So you'll be hearing from them. The sole intent of the bill is to help those who are vulnerable and in need of disability services in order to receive the assistance that will help them lead healthy, productive lives. And like I said, Senator Steiner Hayward is happy to answer medical-related questions, and I'm really not, but I'll try and do whatever I can here. I think you get the gist of what Dr. Eccles is after down in Klamath, and most of his patients are on federal or state health insurance plans, so they're not under private plans or anything like that.
Questions? Representative Gables.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds like a really wonderful bill, actually. Thank you for bringing it to us. I did look. It said there's no fiscal. Is that pretty accurate,
well,
or what do you think?
I think people testifying afterwards will say that there is a fiscal, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Nothing has come up with the bill that I've heard, but I assume that there is, probably.
Follow-up. Yep. Yeah, I think our last meeting, actually, we had a really great presentation by service providers for the developmentally disabled, and again, this just really addresses some of the needs of that special population. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We have two people who've signed up to testify, Leslie Sutton and Cheryl Ramirez.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenningeyer and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Sutton. I'm with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. We're here in opposition today to House Bill 3364 because we believe that this goes beyond the federally recognized definitions of intellectual disability and also the medical definition of intellectual disability. Furthermore, it goes beyond what the intellectual and developmental disability community considers to be an intellectual and developmental disability. We have concerns that an expansion of the definition like this could potentially harm our federal Medicaid match, which was referred to in some of the waivers that were just mentioned. We also believe that this would change the fundamental nature of part of the what we call the DD programs, the programs that are provided by the Department of Human Services. I'd like to note one quick thing in response to some of the testimony that was previously given. Oregon is actually quite liberal in its IQ definitions for people with intellectual disabilities, and we actually do allow up to an IQ of 75 if it also includes significant adaptive behavior deficits, which are things like self-care, mobility, eating, that sort of thing. And so Oregon is really unique from other states in that we do allow up to an IQ of 75. I completely understand that the genesis of this bill is about helping people, and that's not something we are trying to detract from in our opposition today. One of the things that we'd really like to point out is that there are lots of places within the Department of Human Services programs and also within the Oregon Health Authority that can help people to get services they need to manage various medical conditions. Of course, the developmental disability system is happy to do that for people that qualify. There's also the Aging and People with Disabilities program within DHS. There's also the Addictions and Mental Health programs within the Oregon Health Authority. And any of these programs may be able to help the people this bill is trying to address. However, we believe that potentially jeopardizing some of the Medicaid match and fundamentally changing parts of this program is unnecessary at this point. From the testimony that we heard today and also from information that we've heard previously, it sounds like these people might be able to be served already without having to change any law, which is what we would all want. We all want to make sure that people have access to the services that they need. We do recognize Oregon is a really diverse service system, and it's incredibly complex. None of this stuff is easy, and unfortunately it's difficult for professionals to navigate, and it's very difficult for people who are actually using the system to navigate. And I think that this brings up a great point, which is it's really illustrating the need for clear communication from Department of Human Services and from the Oregon Health Authority about exactly how people can access their programs, and if they need help applying, where they can get that help. So again, we don't want to detract from the needs of these individuals. We just believe that there are ways to serve them without having to change the law. So thank you very much.
Maybe let's have both testify and then questions.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. Our association also represents the 32 community developmental disabilities programs across the state of Oregon. And I just really want to echo Leslie's remarks. We're in agreement with everything she said in terms of the problems and also the solutions. We certainly appreciate the spirit for which this bill was intended to assist individuals in accessing services. We're all for that. But expanding the definition of intellectual and developmental disabilities is not the right solution, in our opinion. And it doesn't accomplish the goal. It would open up and change some very complex statutes, actually. And I also want to say that we offer very highly specialized services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. CDDPs serve 22,000 people, and this would just really expand the system to the point that no one would get adequate access to services. So we're really concerned about the increase in numbers. As it is with the K plan and the various waivers, the CMS arrangements, we have a lot more people entering our system, which we're very glad about, and they actually do qualify under this definition of under the federal standards of intellectual developmental disabilities. So the other thing that we're concerned about that Leslie also talked about is slowing down the CMS process for waivers, which is a slow and complicated process as it is. But again, it would decrease immediate or quick access for everyone. So we would really urge you to seek out other ways to accomplish this goal. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I just have a quick question. I'm just a little, it sounds very serious what you're talking about. How did this come to be? Was there a work group, or how did this bill come to be?
So it's my understanding that the bill came to be from the doctor who contacted Representative Whitsitt and Senator Steiner Hayward. The developmental disability community was not included in the preparation of the bill. So I apologize. I don't know any.
I'm just trying to understand. Okay.
Yeah.
The letter that was passed out.
I read the letter. I saw that. I was just confused about it. Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I'm curious. can, it may be a question we need to ask Senator Steiner Hayward, but can you describe the protocol that would be required of this, the type of person, patient that the doctor is talking about? What is, how complicated is the protocol for self-care for a person who would be developmentally disabled and having to do whatever needs to be done?
Chair Kenningeyer, Representative Gallegos, I'm not a medical doctor. I can tell you that DD services are individualized for the individual person. So we see people supported in a variety of different ways across the system. You see people with really high needs that are having 24-hour care to go to work and to be a part of their community, and you see also people that don't need as much support. So I apologize. I'm not a...
Can I follow up with that,
mm-hmm.
too?
Yeah.
And I'm also curious, I mean, you know, again, I'm trying to think about, you know, the, sort of the technical aspect, the medical aspect, but I'm also thinking about the location that, that this comes from, is Klamath Falls, and just thinking about the rural context and the lack of services in those areas, whether they're social services or healthcare services. And I just wonder how much that comes into play with this kind of an issue.
Chair Kenningeyer and Representative Gallegos, Klamath Falls area does have developmental disability services. I think what you bring up is important. You're talking about a workforce shortage as far as who can come and support people. And there is a workforce shortage, of course. However, the developmental disability system does serve people statewide, including in Klamath Falls. And you can do it in a variety of ways. There are some people that do live in more licensed settings, like group homes, for example. There are people that live in the community in their own apartments, and they have people come in and help them. And they can find people to hire to help them do that in a variety of ways. The Home Care Commission, which is part of the state of Oregon, can also help to locate folks. And so that's another way that people can access that, and they can hire workers that they already know, or they can connect with people who are in that profession, and they can have that support in their own home.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kenningeyer. When the individual intellectual quotient is used, or the IQ is used, what variable do you find in that? Meaning, there's been some studies that say if a person takes the test once and then they take the test again, that that's supposed to be a stable number. But in actuality, I think there's a lot more variance in that. And so how do you account for that, and how often does somebody that is affected by an IQ retest it?
Chair Kenningeyer, Representative Hayden, number one, I am not someone, usually we have qualified licensed professionals that do give the IQ test. I am not one of those people. I can tell you the developmental disability system does have what we call redetermination points across a person's life. So when a child comes into the developmental disability system at age 7, they have to be redetermined eligible, which means they go back through the eligibility process and they will look at the IQ. And then again, when the individual is 18, same thing happens again. And that's when they can look at it and see if they're still eligible for services at that point. So you do raise a good point, and it is something that the community, the professional community, is looking at as far as IQs. I will tell you also that there are other ways to become eligible within the developmental disability system that don't require an IQ score, one being having a developmental disability, like cerebral palsy or Down syndrome or something like that. And with that, you would need to have deficits in what we call adaptive behaviors, which again are self-care, mobility, eating, those sorts of things as well. So that those are the three times in a person's life that they would actually have to have, if they're using an IQ score for their eligibility, they would need to have that done at those three points.
I might just follow up on the question. It's okay, 7, 18, however many points you do the redetermination. There's just an awful lot of factors if at 18, 2 weeks later, they did the same redetermination again, which I don't think happens. There could be a significant variance between the first redetermination, 2 weeks later, didn't get enough sleep the night before, whatever, and have a significant difference. So I always get concerned when we have IQ as the determining factor for somebody's benefits.
Thank you.
More of a comment than anything.
Yeah, so I'll just follow up with that. It sounded like it's not always just IQ, and if there are some behaviors that are disabling in some way, it seems to me from reading this letter and the patients that he has that have between 70 and 80 and yet some other disabling factors that are like diabetes that make it very hard for them to manage their lives might qualify. Is that correct?
Chair Kinnegar, that's what we are saying here is based on the information that we've read in the letter and that we understand of the genesis of this bill, we would suspect that there's a way to serve the people that the doctor is trying to help right. already without having to do something else. So I'm happy to try to connect them with the Klamath Falls Community Developmental Disability Program and other DHS offices for sure.
Okay. And then do you also know the numbers of people that are included in the 70 to 80 IQ? Do you have any idea how many hundreds or thousands of people that might be?
Representative Kinnegar, I don't, but we can find out.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3364. I know at least one member is going to have to leave a little bit earlier to do testify in another committee. So I'm going to open a work session on 2889. Robin, could you please read the bill and the proposed amendment?
Sure.
And Jane, could you please come up? Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2889. We heard the bill on March 16th. It directs the Department of Human Services to establish rules and systems for children 12 years or older in custody of the department to establish savings accounts. There is a -4 amendment pending that entitles children in care for 6 months or more receive assistance to establish savings account, prohibits Department of Human Services or other legal guardians as defined to establish accounts on behalf of child, allows DHS to monitor use of child's money relating to state and federal benefits, directs DHS to adopt rules for monitoring child's account activity, directs DHS to encourage youth to establish savings accounts. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. James, could you please introduce yourself for the record, and if there's anything you would like to do to clarify that amendment, there were some very good questions that came up to ensure that kids were not in a position of overdrafting and maybe worsening their credit history for the future, and yet still enabling the intent of this to go forward. I know you've put a lot of attention into that, so if you could just say anything else you'd like to.
Well, Chair Kinnegar, members of the committee, my name is James Barta, Legislative Director for Children First. And we have been, since the last hearing, put in many weeks of work with DHS to try to address all their concerns. And one of the concerns raised by the committee was this possibility of overdrafting. And after more conversations with the credit unions and the banks, unfortunately, we cannot guarantee mm-hmm. that there won't be an overdraft. That would take legislation much larger than I think our relating to clause might permit. But it is an important goal, and I really appreciate that goal, and we agree with that. And so I do want to point out that these youth will have credit checks starting at age 14 from DHS each year. And so we see this as an opportunity for them to learn how to handle their finances while they have someone to keep an eye out for them, because otherwise we'll wait till they're 18 or older when there's no one to keep an eye out. And so these other changes in the -4 amendment since we last spoke are some concerns that DHS raised, making sure that we're not encouraging youth that are in care only for brief amounts of time, hence the 6 months consecutive. We are one of the concerns was some youth receive supplemental security income, and that federal benefit would be cut off if their savings, in the unlikely event, went above $2,000. And so we just want to ensure that DHS is in a position to prevent that from happening. and hence the subsection 6. And the subsection 7 describes it. It will allow us to work with DHS by rule to allow DHS to have the oversight for youth that have intellectual or developmental disability to at least monitor their funds, or if necessary, not encourage them to open an account. And those are the changes. I would be happy to take any questions.
Questions on it? Okay. Can I have a motion? Chair Kenegeyer, I move to adopt. Do I have the right one? I have the right one. I move to adopt the -4 amendments dated 4/3/15.
Vice Chair Peluso moves to adopt the -4 amendments dated 4/3/15. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any objection to the -4s? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Kenegeyer, I move House Bill 2889 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Peluso moves House Bill 2889 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. James, first of all, thank you. We've worked really, really hard on this issue, and I think that our folks who come and lobby for children definitely do like God's work or something, because they're not ever uncomplicated when you're talking about this population of children. James already knows I'm going to be no on this bill, and not because I don't want kids to have bank accounts. The credit implication, even though it's a small population of kids, is really problematic to me. And I personally experienced having my credit completely ruined. And when the first time I went to go get a car at 19, sat there with a lot of debt that I had to go pay off, that I didn't incur as a child. And what happens if you overdraw your checkbook is that my goal here is not to sway anybody on this committee, because I'm just going to be a no for this reason, is if you overdraw it and then you turn 18 and that debt sits there and languishes, even if it's a small amount, it's going to go to a collection agency. It's going to come with then fees and things that we can try to solve in another piece of legislation. But it's going to have this fee implication, and now we owe more than what the original debt was. The ability to go to another financial institution as then an adult is those institutions talk to each other. So I can't just screw up my bank account here and then go over to Wells Fargo and try to get another bank account over here. And the money's sitting there, and there's no mechanism by the state. We say the state wants to take care of these kids. We're not also saying we're going to pay off any damages that a 12-year-old kid made a bad banking decision and maybe had a one-time allotment from grandma, and there was never another allotment to come in, you know, a gift or a check or something that showed up in a bank account. I also have a problem, and James knows, around what happens when some of these kiddos go back into the home situation, and maybe home situation isn't right still, even after return kids, and there is an element of coercion on the part of a parent to try to get the money out, and there's no safeguard in the bill for that, and that the parent can't just walk into the bank as the legal guardian and close the account. So I don't think this has enough safeguards in it for me. The intent is really important, and the work that you're doing on this is great, but I just have to get that on the record, and those are very real concerns. Will it happen to one kid or every kid? I don't know, but the bill doesn't account for that, and I don't know that DHS has a solution for that. So I'm going to be a protest no for that reason only, but the intent's wonderful.
Other comments? Well, I want to thank you for your work. I understand the concerns. I think sometimes perfection is the enemy of the good, and I think that one of the most compelling things that you said was that DHS will be very involved, and so if there is an overdraft, and again, this is just a debit card, right? It's not a credit card, so it's much harder for that to happen anyway, but if there is, you've got DHS checking in and helping correct a situation if it happens at age 14 or 15. one of the things also is this coming out of the Foster Kids conference, which I was at, and you know, I think the problem that they're trying to solve is a much bigger one than this potential, recognizing it's a potential problem, but the bigger one of not being able to have access to it at all sways it as a positive. It's one that I think, you know, we should keep our eye on, and I'm eager to hear reports about. But thank you for all your really hard work on this. Any other comments? Representative Hayden.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. While there are concerns with the bill, and hopefully we can fix that on the Senate side, I'm going to support the bill because I think if we give opportunity for particularly foster children that have probably a higher need to be self-sufficient as they get older, I see this as an entryway. We may have some failures. We may have some growing mm-hmm. pains with it, but maybe we can get a few more protections in it for them. But I think it's a good concept.
Great. Okay. Clerk, can you please call the roll?
Has no authority to fix an individual credit bureau.
Yes.
Pay the debt.
Yes.
So let's fix that.
Aye.
That could be part of the fix.
Aye.
Representative Perry?
No.
Representative
Tanner? Excuse.
President Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Kenner?
Aye. Okay. The motion carries. Representative Peluso, could you please be the carrier?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I will now, well, she's not here. Part of the reason to go ahead was because she was going to be called out.
We have one more on this set. You can
overcast.
Yeah. It's just, are you leaving too?
Just 30 seconds.
Okay.
I'll be right back.
Okay. I will open a work session on 2890. Robin, can you please read the bill? And James, this is James too, right? Why don't you come back up just in case?
James.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2890 directs Department of Human Services in coordination with agencies and foster parents to provide for participation in extracurricular activities for children in care of department. There is a -1 amendment that simply defines extracurricular activities and defines reasonable and prudent parenting standards. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee, my name is James Varda, Legislative Director for Children First. And I just want to add to the description that we added a place in statute where it belongs because there was some concerns from the Oregon Youth Authority that this would cover the relatively small population of their youth, and we wanted to make sure that there was no no crossover with this bill, and let Oregon Youth Authority, who already has an extracurricular program, continue its work. But it's the same bill that was considered previously, so I would be open to any questions you might have.
Any questions?
James, you just mentioned to me a couple minutes ago about this, but what are the current federal guidelines and how this aligns with that?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Stark, thank you so much for mentioning that. The recently passed federal legislation, H.R. 4980, has provisions dealing with foster youth, and one of them is to encourage extracurricular activities. So we found it somewhat serendipitous that at the same time the youth were coming up with legislative ideas in a conference, Senator Wyden and the U.S. Congress was coming up with a similar idea, encouraging extracurricular activities. And one of the provisions in that encouragement is, will, in Oregon, put that as one of the things that a judge in their yearly review to ask how the foster youth is doing with, among all the other things, with extracurricular activities. So this is something that will have a check. So this bill, you know, doesn't have, as it's written, a lot of teeth, but I think it serves an important encouragement and a reminder for DHS to continue helping foster youth reach their potential and find all the activities, as was so well stated by the youth when they testified previously. And so I encourage you to support the bill.
Okay. Any other questions? All right.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 3/16/15.
Vice Chair Stark moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated 3/16/15. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments pass. Vice Chair Stark.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2890 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Stark moves House Bill 2890 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Parrish.
I would love to talk to you offline about a great amendment for this bill. I'm going to vote yes on it, but we should talk.
I'm good. Extracurricular activities.
I can be it.
Okay, good. Any further discussion? Seeing none. Clerk, can you please call the roll?
Rep. Bueller?
Yes.
Rep. Evans?
Yes.
Rep. Gallegos?
Aye.
Rep. Hayden?
Aye.
Rep. Parrish?
Aye.
Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair
Pelosi? Aye. Chair Pinar? Aye. The motion passes. And Representative Stark, would you please be the carrier? Yep. Thank you.
Yes. Chair Kenny Geyer. I ask that rules be suspended to allow Representative Taylor to vote on House Bill 2889.
Okay. Vice Chair Peluso asked to suspend the rules to allow Representative Taylor to vote on House Bill 2889. Is there any objection? Seeing none, clerk, can you please call the roll for her?
Aye. Thank you, Chair Kinnegar.
Okay. We close the work session on 2889 and 2890, if I hadn't done that already. And I will now open a public hearing on 3391 with Representative Evans. Would you like to take the stand while Robin reads the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3391 directs Attorney General to file suit in Circuit Court on behalf of employees of Department of Human Services in certain internally substantiated cases, creates task force on safety for child welfare employees, outlines membership, makeup, and objectives and process, directs DHS to convene and staff task force, compels written report and presentation to legislature by September 15, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. There is a -2 amendment changing the language to allow from shall to may, allows Attorney General to file suit in Circuit Court on behalf of employees of Department of Human Services in certain internally substantiated cases with DHS Director's permission. There is a subsequent referral to Judiciary.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, hi.
Hi.
I'm still Paul, House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem. I'm going to keep my comments.
What's your last name, Paul?
Evans.
Thank you.
Paul Evans. Sometimes Mud, but right now Paul Evans. The focus of this bill is really very simple. We ask folks in DHS and around the state in many different agencies, but in this particular case, DHS, to do some pretty tough things. And sometimes people that are involved in those circumstances don't necessarily agree with what's going on, and sometimes people act irrationally. This is really about the safety of the folks that are doing our interests. They are our agents out there trying to keep kids safe, trying to keep families safe, trying to do things that, again, are sometimes tough to do. Right now, existing realities, somebody can try to go get restraining order, but a lot of the information involved in that process actually, in some cases, makes it worse than better. This program is very simple. It allows DOJ on the behalf of the DHS worker to basically get added protection, and does so in a way that I'm understanding through the approach to amendment process is much more amenable to DHS and DOJ. So from what I understand, the -2 amendments is an improvement. It will help provide a safer work environment for the folks that we're asking to do some pretty tough things. And in simplest terms, I think that we are all better off when we make sure that the folks that we are asking to go and do on our behalf have the tools and the safety to do it in a way that is sustainable. So that's the focus of the bill, and I'll ask for the folks that actually can talk to some of the specifics to join me, if that's okay.
That's great. All right. So
I think they're still here.
I'll call up Steve Lippold, Rhonda Morgan, and Janelle Tefteller.
Hi.
We're nervous.
Well, don't be.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, and members of the committee, my name is Rhonda Morgan, and I work for the Department of Human Services. I work in the self-sufficiency program as a case manager down in Gold Beach. I'm also the statewide president for the sublocal that represents DHS and OHA workers for SEIU 503. I'm here in support of House Bill 3391, which would remove barriers to allow the Department of Human Services to obtain stalking or protective orders on behalf of workers who face that kind of threat as a result of the work that we do. We worked closely with DHS and with the Attorney General's office to get this bill right, because it's important. And we need it right. So you have a dash two amendment in front of you, and we ask you to consider that. We'd also like to thank Representative Paul Evans for bringing this legislation forward. Over the past several years, the agency has seen an increase in both the number and the severity of the threats made against state workers. And whatever the root cause or the contributing factors, the reality is very personal, and it's faced by DHS workers every day who serve some of Oregon's most vulnerable people. The focus of this bill is on our staff at Child Welfare. These workers are tasked with keeping children safe and, if necessary, removing them from harmful home environments. They go into unsafe and emotionally charged situations, often without backup, to respond to reports of children in danger. They need to know that the agency is able to assist and support them should they need it as a result of the work that they do. While we felt the need was most pressing for our child welfare staff, we've also heard from staff in other departments who have faced similar threats, including the vocational rehabilitation counselor, whose client became obsessive and started following her around because she was the only one he felt he could communicate with. To that end, this bill also contains a task force component, which would look at the potential benefits of expanding this policy to other departments. So currently, if a worker is threatened with stalking or harassment as a result of the duties they perform through the course of their work with DHS, the agency is able to and does take some steps to protect those workers. But there are limits to what they can do. And in rare and extreme cases, additional steps are needed. Currently, the worker has to navigate the judicial system on their own, using their own time and personal resources to obtain legal assistance to protect themselves and their families. This bill would allow the agency to work through the Attorney General's office to obtain protective orders on behalf of the employee. What we envision is that after all of the other steps and safety procedures have been exhausted, if it's still needed, the employee would work with the agency management to have DHS request the Attorney General to take action on their behalf. I want to share with you an example of one of the extreme cases I just mentioned. This is the story of a worker who wanted to be here today, but she was scheduled to be in court for one of the children she's working with. She submitted a more detailed written testimony for the committee to read, and so you guys should all have that, and I urge you to read it. It's pretty powerful. She's a child welfare worker at DHS. She lives in a small community near Eugene, and she spent the last 4 years living in fear because of the harassment and stalking by a client. Through the course of her work, Twyla removed a child from an unsafe home environment in 2011. Almost immediately, this person started making threats against her family, including bringing pictures of her child to their initial court hearing. This parent even went so far as to sit outside Twyla's home on one occasion. And due to the limitations on the department, Twyla had to navigate the court system on her own with no support in order to get a stalking order. She had to pay out of pocket for attorney fees and had to do all the work on her own time. She was in a terrifying situation. Her family was threatened, and this was all due to the work that she does for the department. It only makes sense that workers like Twyla get the support from their employer when faced with a situation like this. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Hello. hello, Committee Chair Kenny Geyer and committee members. My name is Janelle Tefteller. I have been employed as a social service specialist with Med for Child Welfare since December 2008. I am also a member of the SEIU Local 503. I support House Bill 3391, designed to protect child welfare workers outside of their workplaces from repeated and alarming contacts by their clients. Every day, child welfare workers put their lives on the line to protect the lives of children. We are committed to this mission. In order to do this important work, we are asking for the same type of protection that we give our clients. My story is not the only story, but it serves to illustrate a gap in the safety for our staff. In June 2011, I was assigned as a caseworker to a client who I will refer to as Mr. F. His daughter was removed from his home and placed with her mother. He lost his job, his housing, and his car. Right away, he began to blame me for his circumstances. He began to make comments to me, which became disturbing and alarming. At one point, he said that he was going to chop me into little pieces. Another time, he became agitated in our office lobby and started yelling at me, threatening to tear down posters and baiting me to stop him. In September 2011, he told a nurse that he was going to find where I lived and kill me and my children so I would know how he felt. I did not have children, but I lived alone, and I knew how easy it could be to find someone's address online. For other reasons, his case was transferred to another worker. He still continued to leave threatening voicemails to his new caseworker, mentioning my name in at least 10 messages that we have recorded. Given his continuous harassment and threats to me and other staff, the department, 2 years later, in 2013, issued a no trespass order. It stipulated that he could no longer come onto state property. After a court appearance in August 2013, a judge dropped the no trespass order when he promised to follow through, when he promised to get mental health treatment. He did not follow through. In February 2014, he resumed leaving threatening voicemails at the office. Finally, on a Saturday in April 2014, I was in the Medford Library, and he came up behind me and whispered in a menacing tone, Janelle, I know what you did. He later admitted to a police officer that he told me I would pay for what I did. Even though I had not been involved in his case for 2.5 years, he continued to blame me for all of the consequences of his actions and his poor life choices. I had become an obsession to him, his threats no longer came from a distance, and I feared for my safety. My manager, the Monday following the Saturday, advised me to call the Medford police. Upon police recommendation, I had to make the effort to take out a stalking order and navigate the court system all by myself. I had to subpoena witnesses and evidence and then prove this case without the assistance of legal counsel, all while dealing with the emotional trauma that had been inflicted upon me. The department did not have the authority to help me. On August 18th, 2014, a stalking order was granted. For over 3 years, I dealt with the chronic stress and anxiety related to this dangerous individual. I limited the places that I shopped, socialized, and recreated. Even with a stalking order in place, I and my coworkers saw him in close proximity to my workplace. Given my continuing fears, I requested and was granted a transfer to another child welfare office in a district 5 hours away. I recently started 2 weeks ago. While I have received some support from DHS, the department could not take further measures to protect me or my coworkers outside of work. If DHS had been able to, I am sure it would have extended more assistance to me. I decided to testify today so that no one else would need to go through what I went through. No one else should feel as alone as I felt. Please allow it the ability to seek further remedies through the Department of Justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your working with children and also your bravery in coming forward.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lippold. I'm Chief Trial Counsel with the Department of Justice, and we are in favor of this bill. As you heard from the testimony given to you earlier, these are real concerns. The problem is that the Department of Justice at this point in time does not have the legal ability to step in on behalf of these DHS workers, and as a result of that, we need this bill to give us that authority to go forward. The Department of Justice represents the state. The state is our client, and we have to stay within the parameters of Chapter 180 in doing that. And so this bill will give us the opportunity, through a request of the agency, to step in and pursue a stalking order. So it makes sense to us. It provides the protection to the DHS employees that are on the front line and gives us the ability to help people not have to try to navigate the legal system on their own, but allow us to step in and do it on their behalf.
questions, Representative Parrish?
Thank you. Appreciate that. First of all, thank you for sharing your story, and I'm so sorry that that happened to you, and I'm going to support the bill. But I want to make sure that if you step in as DOJ, she mm-hmm. doesn't have any cost incurred, I'm assuming, right? We're not going to, because right now, if she goes out and gets her own stalking order, she's got to go get an attorney and go, like, show up at the courthouse on a day off or whatever. Like, there's no financial of the employee. I just want to make sure that that doesn't happen. And then I know that, like, all of our agencies sort of have, like, this line item and that says, you know, money to DOJ as that representation. You know, what's it look like on your end from a cost perspective to actually get that done if she doesn't incur the cost? Because I don't want to see that we're asking her to incur any cost to DOJ at some point.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish, let me start with kind of the process of how that all will work and what cost there would be. The cost would be borne by DHS. It would not be borne by the individual, and that's part of why we want this bill to go through. DHS would have the ability within their budget to seek out legal advice on behalf of their people when they need it, and we would be able to step in and to do that. Now, in terms of any time that might be taken away from a DHS employee's work, they probably would have to appear in court, but with a DOJ attorney. There may be times that they would have to testify and things of that nature. So we would not be able to avoid that, but we would be able to provide the legal guidance and legal advice to help them through that situation. As far as what the cost would be on an individual basis, I don't have that right now, but we could put that together for you folks because we have not really had the opportunity to go forward on these types of proceedings in the past, keeping in mind that each individual case may be very different depending on the circumstances that are there. But it should be a fairly straightforward procedure. It would be some pleadings. It would be showing up in court for us to show cause as to why the restraining order would be necessary or the stalking protective order would be necessary, and for the court to make a determination at that point in time.
Just follow up.
Quick one.
So, you might not be the person to answer it. Maybe somebody from DHS needs to answer it. But 2 years ago, we passed a bill that said that if a public employee was sort of a victim of domestic violence, that they could use any other type of leave to solve that, and there was some additional leave that was granted to them on top of that. And I'm just curious, maybe somebody from DHS needs to answer it, but if that type of leave would be covered to have this type of action, so that, you know, there's not that type of, you know, she's got to go out and deal with the court system off the clock.
Right.
So anyway, just something to throw out there, maybe something
to consider.
We do have
DHS coming up next.
So that's good. Okay, maybe they can answer that.
Yes, and Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Parrish, yes, I think DHS would be a better better person to ask. So.
Good question, though. Representative Gallegos. Yeah,
thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Yes, thank you for your story. I'm sorry you had to go through that. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, we passed a bill in the House that had some similarities. It was basically to protect the information of researchers at the Primate Institute, basically, though, to protect them from stalking, that kind of thing. And I'm just curious about your situation and you know, I assume your information in terms of your home address or stuff like that is relatively easy to get, and I just wonder if we don't need to also think about how do we protect our social workers and child welfare workers in that way, some kind of a screening. But also another question has to do with, and maybe we could get this information, it has to do with, I'm just curious, what's the cost to the state of situations like this? I mean, how many cases do we have, say, in a year? And, you know, if you're having to transfer and you're having to miss work or you're having all of those kinds of things add up to cost to the state. And I think that would be helpful to get a sense of how big of a problem this is.
Thank you for that question, comment. Maybe you can get back to us on that. And Representative Hayden.
I'll hold my question with scope of the concern also. Maybe DHS can answer that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry Weybrand, the last person signed up for this.
Chair
Chair Kenny Geyer and the committee. My name is Jerry Weybrand. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency. And first of all, I don't want to take too much of your time other than say that we're in full support of this bill. And answering some of the questions that I think that I heard from back in the back audience, because this would be authorized by us as a work-related activity, then it would be considered time worked, and it wouldn't have to be something that was taken on their time away.
Thank you.
At this point in time, we're not sure of the total number of cases that would rise. It's been very rare over the last several years that these situations have rose to this level of activity. As you heard earlier on, the type of work that we do, because it's not generally voluntary, it's mandatory clients, there is a level of angst and anxiety and sometimes threats that occur. Generally, they don't rise to the level where someone's being stalked. But when they do, we certainly feel like it's the agency's obligation and responsibility to provide support to our employees. And that's why we urge you to support this bill.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. And I am not an expert in this area, but I think my understanding is that a stalking order is for life and a restraining order is for a set amount of time by a judge. Is that correct?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden, I'm not sure. We could certainly get that information for you.
Okay. And my follow-up to that.
He could answer.
DOJ is in a better position to ask us. Answer that one.
Yeah, I did that backwards, didn't I?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, it was hard to hear back there, but if you could repeat your question.
So my understanding is, and I'm very weak on this, but a stalking order is basically for life, and a restraining order is for a set amount of time. Is that correct?
Could you introduce yourself again?
I will. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lippold, Chief Trial Counsel at Department of Justice, Representative Hayden. Yes, it would be for a more extended period of time. It's not going to have a cutoff to it. But if there comes a point in time when a person wants to challenge whether or not the stalking order should remain in place, they would be able to go back and petition to the court that that be removed. So there's a legal avenue, should I say, of the person to go and have it removed. And it usually has a lot to do with time, circumstances, and things of that nature.
And my follow-up was, I think the only avenue now is for the DHS employees to go file it personally. Do we know how many times that has happened statewide for related to work?
Chair Kenny Geyer, the rest of the committee, what we're aware of, I'm expressing that earlier, that we're not exactly sure. We're aware of two of these situations over the last 2 years. That doesn't mean that across well over 1,000 caseworkers over the last 4 or 5 years that there's been more of those situations, but that's what I'm aware of. So we see it as a fairly rare event that would rise up to our level to make that decision on.
Okay.
Anything else?
Chair?
Yes.
So, Janelle, lots of guts today. I'm very impressed. I am retired from law enforcement, work these kinds of cases. I just give you a huge chops because people will, it takes a long time to report often, and I think it is underreported, much as domestic violence. So we're never going to really get accurate numbers because at times it will go away. Generally, it will come back. So it is really, really important. I am sort of stunned. I guess I've been retired for a handful of years. I didn't realize I'm used to working with district attorneys and in a county setting. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to me that this falls under the Attorney General and the state because of the employer, basically.
Correct.
So really pleased to hear that being strengthened and brought to the forefront. But I think we have the opportunity to educate how severe this can be and how traumatic it can be. And oftentimes, as if you are the victim, you second guess. So don't second guess anything. Do not. You have made a huge difference in the life of many people just by being here today, and that is really, really important. And I support that DHS and DOJ are taking this on, and we're going to make it right as best we can. So I thank you very much for all that.
Yeah, I want to thank everyone as well, and I think there sounds like very, very strong support for this bill. Thank you, Representative Evans, for bringing it. Thank you, Representative Gallegos, for adding some
you know, additional protections to consider. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Nobody's really commented on the task force part of this bill. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, if somebody could comment on that a bit.
Chair Kenny Geyer and the rest of the committee, this actually, as happens oftentimes with bills, the bill is not the point where the conversation began. It's where mm-hmm. the conversation coalesces into a concept to try to provide protection. Actually meet with SEIU members monthly. I called my noon meeting with them, mm-hmm. where we've been talking over about the last year about what we need to do and what the safety issues are, and we've actually moved forward on some issues around safety committees and trying to find a way that we can have that level of security, the best level of security we can for our workers. So we're actually very excited about the idea of the task force, and as it extends not to child welfare but also across DHS, as many of our workers, including, say, APS workers and some of the workers that work some of the institutions, find themselves in places where they have threats made against them, perhaps not always rising to the level of needing a stalking order. And there are certainly things that we currently do. The testimony, Janelle, the caseworker, talked a little bit about that we do try to attempt to provide that safety, and we'd love to look at what other options there are to kind of enhance that for our workers. So we're actually very supportive of the task force and would like to see that as part of this bill.
And if I could add to that, Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Stark, members of the committee, is that one of the benefits of having that task force would be also for us to see if there's opportunities to expand this, frankly, outside of DHS. You know, the way the bill is constructed at this point in time and with its relating clause, we're really kind of tied to DHS at this point in time. But there are other agencies throughout the state and other state workers that face similar types of situations. DOJ is similarly handcuffed, if you will, to be able to step in on their behalf. And so there's always the likelihood that next legislative session, with some of the information we have from the task force and some of the history that we have with this bill moving forward, we may be able to expand it for a broader application and allow us to give some protection to people throughout the state.
That's great. Thank you so much. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3391 and open a work session on House Bill 2564. Robin, could you please read the bill and the amendment? And Representative Kotek, would you like to come?
Mr. Chairman, is
it? He'll come up with you? Great. And can we have one other person who's going to comment too. Should you all three come up, Diane Lynn, at the same time? Come on up.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2564 repeals statute that prohibits local governments from imposing conditions that would affect price of residential housing or direct purchase by a particular group. There is a -4 amendment pending, adds conditions that no more than 30% of housing units are sold below market rate, outlines applicable incentives for housing developers. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Madam Speaker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's nice to see you. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative from House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Thank you for the opportunity to return today to talk to you about House Bill 2564. I'm here today in support of the -4 amendment. As you know, the underlying bill would have simply lifted the statewide preemption on the ability of local governments to implement inclusionary zoning for the purpose of increasing access to affordable housing in their community. In the course of doing any bill, you want to make sure you hear all sides. And I want to thank Mr. Chandler and the Home Builders Association for expressing their concerns about this type of lifting of a preemption. And what you see in the -4 is an attempt to do two things. One, maintain the ability of local governments to have flexibility to meet their needs, but also make sure that there are some sideboards on the use of inclusionary zoning so there can be some certainty from the folks who are building the new housing that it will not be abused. So what you see in the amendment, it says that inclusionary zoning could be allowed as long as there are two criteria. One, wouldn't apply to more than 30% of housing within a residential development. So trying to reach below market rates, but capping that total amount that could be used for inclusionary zoning at 30% of all available housing. And then offers and says, you want to make sure that there are incentives involved to help developers do this type of thing. And it lists a list of items that one or more of the following types of incentives could be employed by local government: density adjustments, fee waivers or reductions, waivers of system development charges or impact fees, finance-based incentives, preferential treatment for processing and permits, expedited service for local approval processes, or modification of height, floor area, or other site-specific requirements. Many of these things are already employed now, but the goal here is to say inclusionary zoning is an important tool, but we want to make sure we know how it's going to be used broadly, because we don't want to impede local flexibility to do this. And every community is a little different. So you don't want to say it has to be this type of incentive or this, you know, size of incentive, because every community is going to be different. And let's remember, not every community is going to want to do this. This is about choice at the local level. And we think it reaches the goals of allowing another tool for local government with some criteria, and we think it's the right way to go. So I would urge your support of the Dash 4 amendments and move the bill today if you are so inclined. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Mr. Chandler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on the Dash 4 amendments, and I really appreciate the Speaker's willingness and yours, Madam Chair, to work with on this bill. If you were listening earlier today, you may have heard a squealing noise, and that was my conference call with my client as they were trying to get around the corner on the lifting of the preemption. And I won't belabor the arguments I made in my earlier testimony on this issue. That has been a very important part of our policy for almost 20 years. And the notion of lifting it makes us very nervous for reasons that I stated earlier. In our conversation today, we agreed that we would be there's something along the lines of the Dash 4s. We can't support the Dash 4s, and I've communicated that to the Speaker's staff. But we certainly will now be more than happy to entertain further discussions about, once the preemption comes off, how do you sideboard it? And I really appreciate the attempt to put those sideboards in. And I think the discussion that I would hope to have either in this committee or in the Senate will be seen as, from the Speaker's standpoint and yours, Madam Chair, in this committee, as a reasonable attempt to get to those sideboards, whether 30% is the right number, perhaps adjusting the fee reductions have to be meaningful, not a $10 reduction on things like that. But I think the things we can do, because we've never really engaged, and it wasn't until this session, frankly, that we had to engage on, okay, what would an inclusionary program look like that was fair to the industry and actually had some impact on the ground? You've got our attention, shall we say, and that is a good conversation to have. So I'm here to say if the bill stays in this form, unfortunately, we couldn't support it. Mm-hmm. The discussion, though, is one we will support. We pledge to you that we would be able to come back, hopefully, with something, or here in this chamber, if you have the time to do so, that comes up with a set of amendments that will provide the sideboards protection for our folks, a tool for local governments that we hope will then be put to good use to provide more affordable housing. And as just one idea, if you don't mind, with the Speaker's indulgence, since she's here, and yours, Madam Chair, we do have another bill that's working its way through this process in a different committee that, as an example of the sort of sideboard I think might be helpful, that it deals with the issue of expedited land divisions. It's House Bill 3233, for those of you keeping score at home, when it gets to the floor. We're amending that bill. It sets up a 60-day turnaround process, a much shorter appeal period at the local level, very limited local appeals for high-density projects. It's been on the books for 25 years, or almost that. We're going to be amending it to make a few tweaks to it, but also I'm suggesting that we apply it to affordable housing as well. And so one of the cross incentives we might be able to provide is anything that's inclusionary zoning gets that treatment. I'm thinking out loud here to a certain extent. That would be a significant act, I think, both for our industry and for affordable housing to get stuff permitted faster, quicker, with more certainty. So with all that, Madam Chair and Madam Speaker, thank you very much. This has been a good conversation. I hope to continue it in ways that get both of us something that we can take credit for at the end of the session as having advanced affordable housing.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. And just a quick question. You said you were opposed to the amendment. Did you mean you were opposed to the bill, but you support the amendment, at least as a partial, going in the right direction?
That's a very good question, Madam Chair. If the bill stayed in its current form, we would, and I regret this, we would have to oppose.
Right.
We are not going to be we're not going to beat anybody up in the House,
But do you oppose the amendment?
We would support putting the amendment in the bill. It goes
support
the
amendment.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear about that.
Okay.
This is much better than the base bill. Much, 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 much better. Okay. And I think now, and the issue for us was that preemption. And that's and I realize that not everybody sees that as big an issue as it was from our clients, but it was an immense lift to get them to that point. Okay. Not that I'm taking credit for it. We had a very interactive and frank and open discussion over the last couple of weeks. Now that we're at that point to figure out, okay, how do we make it work? These amendments go a very significant part of the way there. And in my mind, and I recognize that one person's tweak is another person's, oh my Lord, you've gutted it. But I really do believe sincerely that we could come up with some relatively modest tweaks to this that would make it something we could support. And as I say, at the end of the session, take credit for moving the ball forward on affordable housing.
Thank you. Should we hear from everyone and then?
It's on that.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, this interaction just confused me. So what I hear you saying is that you support the -4 amendments because they're headed in the right direction, but you still oppose the bill even with the -4s.
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, it's not uncommon in this process for things to get partway through in one chamber. And I'm not suggesting that this isn't a very good effort, and I'm being quite sincere here. We do appreciate it. The way this is worded, a 30%, and I'll give you an example, a three-lot subdivision could trigger this. And part of our concern all along, if you remember our earlier testimony on the base bill, was that this, if this is going to work, it has to be something that can't be abused locally. And I'm not saying that it would be, but the fact that a three-lot subdivision, one of those houses might have to sell below market, makes us very nervous, because then you end up with a situation where you simply don't have enough volume of sales to offset whatever that diminution of value might be. There's a threshold there. I think Montgomery County, Maryland uses 20 lots or something. That's one of the standard inclusionary zoning ones, that below which you don't apply the inclusionary zoning. So because in our standard, even if there's offsets in terms of the sub A through G there, or excuse me, sub B, A through G, the offsets, if they don't match up to the price, in other words, they don't completely compensate the developer for what they would have sold the property for otherwise, if you have enough units, you can amortize that cost across, and the developer then has reason to continue with the project. That's where that threshold would come in. So it's things of that sort that are very industry-specific that we would bring to the table and say, if it's lower than this or this number doesn't work for us, but this number would, that I think we would be able to support. So when I say we're not all the way happy yet, that's simply an honest statement. In terms of the bill moving forward, we absolutely support it moving forward, so we can have that conversation.
Thank you very much. You have a quick question?
Well, and actually, John, I think you sort of touched on it, because line 13, a residential development, could be anything to anybody, and each city could sort of come in and say, well, that residential is 3 or 5, and 30% of 5 is a 1.5 of a house. Like, that doesn't quite, the language, I think, is not clear, and that's problematic. I'd like to see that get fixed. You answered, I think, my question, and I'm just reading it that way, and I think I'm reading it right.
Okay, Representative Buehler, Representative Evans, and remember, we've got one more speaker here who might also be able to answer some questions.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. I'm just curious, what do you foresee finance-based incentives? What can you give me an example of what that is with regards to the incentives that could be offered to developers?
Madam Chair and Representative Buehler, thank you for the question on the -4. Actually, this list came from a list from Mr. Chandler, so maybe he can answer that question. I'm not familiar about what that would mean at the local level, but thank you for the question.
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, that was intended to be broad. It could be participation in financing. Some jurisdictions around the country would have inclusionary zoning programs, have the ability at the local level to underwrite private mortgage insurance or to buy down interest rates. In the current lending climate, that's not as big a deal. If interest rates start to go back up, which I assume they will eventually, then having some fund at the local level that could help buy down those rates for either construction side or the sales side, private mortgages, would be helpful.
Would it include property tax abatement?
Madam Chair, property tax abatement, it could, I suppose, and like I say, those were not particularly scientifically chosen words when intended to be broad. Once you get into property tax abatement, you get into not only above my knowledge level, but an immensely complicated area at the local level, thanks to Measure 5 and Measure 50. But yes, for the record, I suppose, yeah, absolutely it could, and yep. Somebody smarter than me would figure out how to do it.
Yep. Representative Evans.
Not a question, but a comment and kind of a sidebar answer to that.
thank you guys for getting it where it's at right now. As a former mayor, I'm very excited about the possibilities of what can be done with the lifting of the preemption, but a guarantee of some type of financial incentives. I have a bill in this session that is tied to energy production on and splitting off net metering so that it provides subsidy over time to help incentivize some of these activities. Looking at perhaps some of the economic development zones that we currently do for commerce, we could theoretically, I think, use that as a model for certain types of housing on the property tax side. I think that there's a number of things that can be done with this framework, and I'm really excited that we're where we're at, and I just want to say thanks for getting it here.
Okay. Ms. Lynn.
Good afternoon, Chair, and please let me begin by saying thank you to Speaker Kotek for us getting this bill to this point in the process, and thank you, John Chandler, for being here to have the conversation that's so very important to have. And we, I will introduce myself. I'm sorry, Chair. Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to provide some comments on the Dash 4 amendments. My name is Diane Lynn. I'm Executive Director of Proud Ground. We're a nonprofit providing permanently affordable homeownership to working families. I'm also, and our service area is the metropolitan area and Lincoln County. I'm also a former member of the Board of County Commissioners in Multnomah County and spent about 14 years at the local government level. I work with and am very proud to represent today a broad coalition of stakeholders, including housing, land use advocates, racial, social, local governments, environmental justice organizations, labor groups, senior citizens, environmental organizations, progressive developers, and the Oregon Housing Alliance. These groups consist of tens of thousands of Oregonians across the state and include many residents that are really struggling every day to find appropriate housing. Remember, 60% of the jobs created in the state of Oregon were at 60% of median income. IZ is one of the best tools to use to help deal with affordable housing for our workforce, as you've heard before. And you all know, as you heard before, that the affordability crisis is not just in Portland and Multnomah County. It's all around the state, the cities of Corvallis, Ashland, Eugene, Wilsonville, Milwaukee, Hood River, along with Lincoln County, have joined Portland and Multnomah County to ask to repeal this ban. And these jurisdictions represent a variety of different kinds of housing markets, different policy needs, and that is why IZ is such an important tool. It can be customized and adapted. Now, as it goes in politics, we're here to kind of cook some sausage together, and we're also going to say that we're not completely happy with the Dash 4 amendments, and we just want to explain briefly why, and let's see how we can get going forward. And we just need to share our perspective on that and then see if we can really create something meaningful here together. Of course, we support the base bill that repeals ORS 197.309. The Dash 4 amendments effectively replaces that blanket prohibition with a conditional one, leaving a limited prohibition in place. Any type of prohibition on inclusionary zoning, of course, is frustrating for those of us at the local level, and it limits local jurisdictions from benefiting from the breadth of that policy tool. The whole point, of course, is local jurisdictions know their housing markets best and should have the authority to adapt the policy accordingly. That said, capping the below market rate set aside at 30% is reasonable, and it is consistent with the national best practices. After review of over 100 different inclusionary programs out of 500 nationwide, most fall between 15 and 25% range. Capping the set aside at 30% would still allow local jurisdictions to adopt effective ordinances, we believe. The major concern is that it requires developers specific offsets, benefits, and in order to adopt IZ. Jurisdictions might choose to provide developers with such offsets, but there may be many other things they could do, many flavors of IZ. This amendment, in some cases, we could say ignores that body of evidence. Again, we're working together to sort this out, figure out how to go forward. This is about local control. It's also about making some great progress at a critical point in time. It is not because the cost, this is because the cost of inclusionary zoning is borne by the landowners, not by the developers, and not by the market rate homeowners or renters. Again, the research of this program nationwide in the past 40 years has shown that landowners ultimately bear the cost of inclusionary zoning. And as the market adjusts and developers negotiate lower prices, requiring jurisdictions to provide developers with offsets they don't need just doesn't make sense on its face. And Cornerstone Partnership has much more information about this. Remember, local governments make a lot of important decisions that actually increase the cost, the value of land, oftentimes too, as does the market, as we've seen all around the state. Two features of the effective IZ programs that are missing from the Dash 4 amendments are the in-lieu fee option and the administrative hardship exemption process, because there are some businesses this just really doesn't make sense for. And these are two features more than the list of benefits listed in the amendment that jurisdictions would normally use first to provide developers flexibility. The other feature that precedes inclusionary ordinances is a financial fiscal study. This is done oftentimes. These studies tell jurisdictions what the right parameters are and an effective policy that could be used to identify just the right components of the ordinances. We believe that if the legislature really, and I believe is appropriately concerned about protecting developers from extreme applications of inclusionary zoning, it should lower the maximum set aside to perhaps 20% and require the use of offsets, administrative hardship exemption processes, and feasibility studies for anywhere beyond that. Sounds like that's the kind of conversation we can continue, and we're very excited about the prospect of having opportunity to do that. With all that said, we are anxious to see this bill move forward and welcome any progress on the base bill or amendments today so we can advance this amendment forward. And as you all know, time is of the essence. We're losing affordability every day for working families. Thank you so much for your time.
Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. I share your passion for affordable housing in Oregon. It's a big, big problem, and it's growing bigger every month. And it's certainly a big problem in my district, where vacancy rate is now at 0.25%. However, I can't support this, and it's not because I don't share your goal. I just think you're misdiagnosing the problem. And in my world as a doctor, if you misdiagnose something, it can many times lead you down a treatment path that actually makes the patient worse. And I'm afraid that's what we're doing here. I think the bigger causes of our affordable housing crisis are the high SDCs many cities are charging developers. I think it's a mismatch of supply and demand of land because of our clunky UGB approval process. I think it's because of a dysfunctional capital market, which makes it very hard to fund many of these projects. I think it's because of a housing agency in Oregon that's also dysfunctional, as we've seen in testimony in this committee, where there's $20 to $30 million that's not being deployed that should be deployed for affordable housing. It's just sitting in their accounts. And I think we also have to keep in mind that it's because of a falling per capita wage in this state over the last 20 years. It's fallen more in this state in the last 20 years than any other state in the union. I think those are the things that are causing affordable housing crisis. And I think I'd love for you to work on solving those problems also.
Okay, not seeing any questions. I just want to make a comment also. First of all, how pleased I am that we're moving forward with this discussion. Living in Portland, I can speak mostly from the Portland perspective of having watched the Pearl get developed in South Waterfront Division, which is very close to where I live, and now in my area, Gleason, Burnside, 82nd Avenue, that we've had a lot of new developments and people are getting pushed out. And my particular district has people who can afford higher end and also who cannot. I'm right on the dividing line there. One of the things about this bill that I think is really important is that we're not trying to diagnose the problem as one particular problem. We're allowing local governments to do that. I think that's really, really a critical piece here, is to allow local government the opportunity to say, what is the particular problem where I live? And so where I live, having people pushed out of inner city Portland, closer to where their jobs are, and out to East County, East Portland, where the transit is not as good, where they spend an hour getting into work on low wages. Another problem that we need to work on a lot of different fronts. So the gentrification issue is really critical. This alone, this particular tool to put in the toolbox, is not going to get at quantity of affordable housing in the ways that some of the other tools in the toolbox will. We say if you have 20%, out of 100 units, you're going to get 20 units, or out of 10 units, you get 2 units, is not going to solve affordable housing, but it will allow for the kind of society that many of us want, which is mixed housing, mixed income schools. There's so much research that shows how important that is, and so this really gets at not having a problem, and this is a problem very specific to the area that I represent, where you've got all wealthy people living in one area and all poor people living in another area. And it's just one of the best tools to get at that very specific problem. So I think affordable housing, yes, I think a lot of the things on the list that you have come up with to offset costs are ones that are regularly used in trying to develop a bigger quantity of affordable housing. I do want to just say for the record, too, that this refers to sales, not rentals. There's been some confusion around this. This does not give local governments the authority to regulate rental price at all. I do think it'll have some impact on the rental market, because as we help first-time homeowners have some access to buying a home for the first time, it will release the pressure that's on the rental market, where we have too many people bottled up on the rental market. So that is another one of the problems that we have right now, is not enough access to first-time home ownership, and we have a lot of people in rent, and the rents are astronomical right now, at least in Portland. I can speak for the people that I represent. I know that we've heard this from across the state as well, but I think allowing local government the opportunity to identify the problem and giving them as many tools in the toolbox as possible. So if it is a question of gentrification, that may not be as much of a problem in other areas where you don't have segregated classes of people living and schools that are very low income, very high income. But for many communities, that is a really crucial issue. And so I appreciate adding another tool to the toolbox. I might make the amendment, the incentives that you put here, including but not limited to. I think some of the suggestions of broadening it are good and can strengthen it. But I really appreciate the effort, and I'm very excited to see this go forward.
Thank you.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'll be a yes on the dash form, maybe a no on the overall bill, but Madam Speaker, I appreciate you bringing this and being passionate about this. I know this is truly a near and dear to your heart issue, and you care about it greatly, and I trust you in that you care about it greatly, and that you've been slogging at this since before you were the Speaker. So my challenge with this concept, as somebody who knows we need housing, right? I grew up chronically homeless. I get we need housing, and I grew up in these same neighborhoods we're talking about where we want to see affordable housing. Is that the inclusionary zoning, as I understand it, is basically saying, you said the cost is borne by the landowner. We're asking the landowner to take a hit, financial hit, to do inclusion, or we're asking somebody to take a financial hit to do the inclusionary zoning, and then we're saying to the person who gets to be the recipient of that affordable housing that you buy that housing, and in the future you get to sell that housing, that you make the money. So I would be okay with that if we actually offset all the risk to the person who is putting the skin in the game, which is either the landowner or the builder, or sometimes both. That could be a change in how we do capital gains for people who do and commit to building affordable housing. It could be all manner of things to get us there. But to say that we're asking somebody else to make less money, and the government's going to say, local, state, whatever, is going to say, we want you to make less money, but we're going to let somebody else make money on the back end over here, and it wasn't their money to make to begin with, is philosophically a problem for me. And that's what this bill does. I'm also very frustrated, colleagues, that I spent the last year and some change on the affordable work group, ABC work group on housing, and I've not seen those bills come to the floor yet. They were consensus housing bills that I put a year and some change of my time and energy into, and they're not here. And I don't know why that is, and I want one of the 100 million buttons for my button sweater, because I support that, and that hasn't happened yet. $100 million of bonds for affordable housing. Where are those bills that were consensus-based? So I'm really struggling with, if we're going to go out and say, here's what we came up with, and then not do that and go right back to where we started, which was, we don't have consensus here yet.
and pass that bill, that feels intellectually dishonest to me. And that's not to blame anybody on this panel, but that's, I spent a year of my time doing that, and I'm very frustrated by that. So
I see some other questions over here. I'd like to just respond to that, because we have heard a number of those, and there have been issues that have come up. Some of them have been that ODOT and others could do some things administratively. As I understand it, I'm not sure. I think you might be a chief sponsor on a bill that just came through that has just been first read and I think yet to be assigned to this committee.
Hopefully
I'm looking forward to it. That combines a couple of the bills. Another one had to do with debt indebtedness, you know, to the ballot measure, and I think we had pretty broad consensus that that was not going to go anywhere in the ballot measure. So I really appreciate the work that you've done on the ABC, you and Representative Reardon have done. I know that's ongoing, and again, this is all about having as many tools out there as possible. There's been some good ideas. I think that they're still continuing to go through. I'm certainly looking forward to the $100 million in bonding, and we are early in the session. We have, you know, I fully anticipate for those to move forward. I'm excited about that. So, Representative Buehler and then Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Kinigauer. A comment and then a question. The comment is, I agree with you with regards to those neighborhoods being mixed and diverse. I happen to live in one. I have an affordable housing project two blocks from my house, and the houses range considerably, and it is a very rich, dynamic neighborhood. I call it sometimes eclectic because of the activities, but I love living there. I think that's an admirable goal that we should all work towards. I think, though, that those are societal goals that should be bore by the society. And I think the mechanisms, the levers, the incentives that you include in Dash 4 are those types of incentives that we all would have to pay for to further those goals, including property tax abatement. I think that's just a more just way of handling this problem. But we'll set that aside. My question is, and it leads off of Representative Parrish's comment. I do see a problem with this. So either someone has a windfall if they get one of the, if they are fortunate enough to get the inclusionary zoning house, because when they sell it, it's going to raise up into market levels. So essentially, they not only got a great opportunity with the inclusionary zoning, but they also kind of won the lottery, so to speak, because they're going to get this big increase in value when they sell it. Or I guess if you didn't want to allow that, you could price fix, but then you eliminate one of the key wealth-creating engines in our society is gaining equity in your home. So how do we take care of that problem, either a windfall or decreasing their ability to generate equity?
Madam Chair and Representative Buehler, good question. I think I would just broadly say, and perhaps Ms. Lynn would, given her current job, could answer further, but I think we have to remember that affordable housing and making sure we have enough stock of affordable housing in every community is very complex. You found that out on the work group. The issue of what inclusionary zoning will do, you're pointing out one of the flaws of talking about only what happens around, you know, new home development and what happens on the resale. Very valid. There are land trusts that also have a different approach. There are a lot of different things we need to do and provide for local communities to make sure they can meet their affordable housing goals. This is only one thing. And I mean, that's my general response to that. I don't disagree with your questions. I just think there are many things we need to be doing. This is one of them, and it's not going to solve the whole problem off the get-go.
Thank you, Speaker Kotek. I would add to that that, in fact, again, jurisdictions across the country, and we're doing some research and we're finding out more about how they've done this. In fact, it is going to be important to see how this plays out. And the land trust connection with inclusionary zoning can be very effective at holding those units of housing in affordability in those communities to create that economic and cultural diversity that we all so much want to have here in the state of Oregon, by holding the essentially the land in trust and having a shared equity model that upon resale, the owners actually do get 25% of the increased value and everything they put in out, way better than having to try to rent in the market or try to buy on the market right now. Very hard for them to do, and they're falling farther and farther behind. 50% of their incomes are going to their housing costs. In the land trust, not only do the families walk away with a piece of equity they wouldn't have ever earned, save money along the way, another family, income qualified family below 80% of median income, would then be qualified to purchase that same unit. So we'll be working very hard, when we hope to make great progress on this, to apply that for the, that kind of model for exactly this reason, in partnership with a lot of other agencies like Habitat and others.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. First of all, I sort of parrot and ditto for much of what's been said up here already, but particularly with Representative Buehler's points about this being a very complex issue and diagnosis being very complicated, but also that, you know, this bill offers a tool. And for me, this is really an issue of equity. I mean, it really is equity, and the question of how can we reduce barriers to opportunity, and to me, this is really an opportunity that we could get onto, and it has more to do with just diversifying community. It really has to do with reaching our 40-40-20 goals, our workforce goals of the future. We cannot continue as a state to ignore these communities that demographically are growing, but they're still staying at the bottom of our income level. How do we change that system? And I think that's what we have the opportunity to do here. Thank you.
May I add a quick comment about that?
Yeah.
Representative Gallegos, in fact, homeownership really is a way for people to gain equity. It is a way for them to have a piece of the community they're part of, to anchor there, to be able to plant gardens, have pets, have their children be able to attend to the public schools and the parks and the libraries we work so hard to develop in our communities. So that is a way to break the cycle of poverty, to go forward, and every step we can make in that direction is a good one.
If I might, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. to that point, I went to the Neighborhood Partnerships Conference last year. They had a speaker, and I don't recall where he was from, Brandeis University, I believe, who had a fascinating chart, and I confirmed it with our national group that their numbers matched up. And it had to do with the average familial wealth of African-American families and Caucasian families. And I don't recall the numbers now, but the gap was huge. And the major driver of that was home ownership, because the Caucasian families, on balance, tended to own their own home more often and had more equity built up in that than the African-American families. That was is a huge issue in our society, not just for wealth creation, but for stability, for schools, for all of that, to the extent that from a home builder standpoint, obviously, very parochially, we want more people buying homes. How you get to that and how you get people on that home ownership ladder is extraordinarily complex, and I hope as this bill moves forward, we can entertain this committee and others' attention on issues of land supply, issues of development barriers, those sorts of things that tend to become almost standalone measures, when in fact, I believe they're part and parcel of this giant puzzle we're trying to fix. Representative Buehler's point to wealth, do you cap the wealth? Do you have an equity share with the land trust or some other mechanism, or do you have the habitat model where they get to keep it? That's an extraordinarily complex question. There's good arguments on both sides. The local infrastructure to manage that is going to have to be created, and we have to be thought through very carefully, both at the legislative level at some point, but also at the local level, on how you manage these programs going forward. The timing of implementation is going to be part of it. All of this is extraordinarily complicated, and not only complicated, which is not a reason to not do it, it's a reason to do it right. It's extraordinarily important that we do that.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get the motion for the amendment.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the -4 amendments dated 4-2 of 15.
Vice Chair Stark moves to adopt the -4 amendments dated 4-2-15. Is there any more discussion on the amendments?
This is one of those moments I wished we had to second something, because I'd second that.
Okay, good. Well, you can say that in your discussion. Are there any objections to the amendments? All right. Seeing none, the amendments pass. And Vice Chair Peluso.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2564 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Peluso moves House Bill 2564 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Rep. Buehler?
No.
Rep. Evans?
Yes.
Rep. Gallegos?
Yes.
Rep. Haven?
No.
Rep. Parrish?
No.
Rep. Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
No.
Vice Chair Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Pingar?
Aye. The motion passes.
I am happy to carry the bill unless the speaker would like to carry the bill. Would you like to carry the bill? She's declined. Okay, great. Then Carrie will be the speaker. And that is it. So I adjourn the committee.
There you go.
House Committee on Human Services and Housing.
They're running out.